This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after a lot of loss in the last couple of years, an expert on grief joins the show with some reassurance and advice. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Myth of Closure. Now, President Biden is heading to Brussels next week for a NATO summit on Russia's war with Ukraine. The meeting comes at an important time for the military alliance as it tries to figure out how big a role to play in the conflict, and as President Biden has warned against Russia attacking NATO countries.
As I made crystal clear, the United States will defend every inch of NATO territory with the full force of American power. And the good news is, NATO is more united and more determined than ever.
We're taking a closer look at the NATO alliance, how it works, its past, present, and future, and its role in responding to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad the U.S. is still part of NATO? Do you think it's a good thing to have an alliance like this that could counter countries like Russia? Or do you think its time has passed with the end of the Cold War? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Monahan is a visiting fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He focuses on European security and defense. We're talking to him in that capacity today. He also works for the UK Ministry of Defense, where he focuses on international defense policy, including NATO. Sean, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I want to listen to a little more of President Biden. This was an address to the nation after Russia invaded Ukraine last month.
There is no doubt that the United States and every NATO ally will meet our Article 5 commitments, which says an attack on one is an attack on all.
That's one of the core ideas of the NATO alliance. Can you talk about that commitment and the wider role of NATO?
Absolutely, Rob. So, as you say, and as President Biden alluded to, the most important aspect of NATO, so NATO is a political military alliance of 30 nations, mostly in Europe, but also the US and Canada, focused on security in Europe and the Atlantic region. NATO was formed in 1949 in the Washington Treaty, and the most important fact about NATO is indeed this Article 5 provision. And that is, if you like, the Three Musketeers clause, the all for one and one for all. So what it means, Rob, is that an attack on any member of NATO would be considered as an attack on the whole alliance, and the whole military weight of the alliance would be brought to bear on the aggressor.
As you mentioned, 1949 was the year this started. The threat I think everybody had in mind then was the Soviet Union and then its allies or satellite regimes in the Warsaw Pact. That's over. What is NATO's role in a post-Cold War world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess a lot of people thought or at least hoped that we'd seen the end of NATO, because NATO was created, as you suggest, to counter aggression from the Soviet Union, now Russia. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, many folks thought that, you know, NATO's days were numbered. And in fact, this would actually be quite a good thing, because it would represent NATO, you know, would not be needed anymore. Fast forward 30 years, Russia has invaded its neighbor Ukraine, and it's become all too clear to all of us watching on our screens the horrific scenes that are unfolding in Ukraine that NATO really is more necessary than ever to protect its members from Russia, which under President Putin is clearly unafraid to use military power to subjugate other nations in a way that we really have not seen on this scale, I'm afraid, since the Second World War.
Now, Putin has cited NATO expansion eastward as one of his grievances that led, among other things, to this invasion of Ukraine. The invasion of Ukraine, though, has given Putin's non-NATO neighbors maybe a real incentive to join NATO. Can you talk about that tension over, are we provoking a leader like Putin by expanding NATO versus providing needed protection to neighbors given his aggression?
Yeah, absolutely. So Indeed, Mr. Putin has made a number of arguments, some of them fairly incoherent. One of them being, indeed, that NATO presents a threat to Russia. I suppose I would look at it the other way round. So NATO, since the end of the Cold War, has expanded by a number of nations. So those ex-Soviet Union countries that you referred to and ex-Warsaw Pact countries, mm-hmm. most of them have now joined NATO. They have taken an independent democratic decision and they have amended their constitutions to join NATO based on the public opinion in those democratic nations. So they have decided to do that. The reason they have decided is because they have a neighbor who has appeared over the years to be revisionist and aggressive. And, those nations that have joined in the past 20 years are probably quite glad that they have done so, because we now see that this exactly turns out to be the case, that Russia under Mr. Putin is unafraid to use military power to invade and use overwhelming force against civilians in a completely illegal and unjustified and unprovoked manner. So they are justified in joining NATO. You mentioned Ukraine. Ukraine did have a path to membership in NATO. In 2008, in Bucharest, a treaty was signed, or a memorandum, an agreement that both Ukraine and Georgia would be put on a path towards NATO membership. Now, they weren't very close to becoming members. And let me just briefly explain why. Mm-hmm. To become a NATO member requires satisfying a number of criteria, both about the democratic institutions within the country, so NATO is an alliance of democracies, and also about the state of the military forces of the nation. So NATO is an alliance of advanced military forces. So Ukraine had not met those targets yet, but was undertaking a process to meet those targets. By all accounts, it wasn't very close. This was a number of years off. So, to use the excuse that Ukraine was just about to join NATO is just factually incorrect.
We're talking about NATO, the U.S. role in it, and NATO's role in responding to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Sean Monahan is with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about NATO, with your thoughts on what you want to see the U.S. and NATO allies do in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, or not do. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sean, there's been, I think, two lines of criticism of NATO and its response to the invasion, that it's doing too little or too much. Let's start with the too much, the idea that Ukraine is not a member of NATO. It's not subject to the Article 5 clause requiring this defense. By providing a lot of arms to Ukraine, NATO could be ratcheting up tensions with Russia even more. What do you say, first of all, to that line of concern?
Yeah, well, NATO nations, and let's remember, by the way, NATO is an alliance of democratic nations. So it's not too much on its own. It's a set of offices in Brussels, really. NATO represents the views and the military capabilities of those 30 nations. So it's really up to those nations to decide what they want to do and how they want to help or not in the situation. I think people say, well, why isn't NATO doing this? Again, NATO is a collection of democratic nations. So what NATO does and doesn't do ultimately comes down to public opinion. On the doing too much angle, so NATO nations have quite a fine line. They're walking a bit of a tightrope in that they clearly want to do, they have a moral compunction to do as much as possible to help the people of Ukraine cope with this terrible situation that they find themselves in. But at the same time, if NATO does too much and gets too directly involved, there is always the risk of what is a dreadful war in Ukraine becoming a much larger conflict. So that's the fine line that NATO nations are treading in their response.
I wanted to ask you about one specific element of accusations that NATO countries aren't doing enough, the idea of a no-fly zone. Ukrainian President Zelensky made the case for that repeatedly, including to the U.S. Congress. Why would NATO countries be reluctant to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine?
Yeah, so the Ukrainians have asked for this repeatedly. And this is something we've done as a NATO alliance and other coalitions in a number of conflicts, from over the skies of Iraq and over the skies of the Balkans as well in the 90s, and since in Libya as well, I believe. So we can do this. The difference is between those conflicts, those civil wars, and the situation in front of us is that a no-fly zone, Rob, would require NATO forces to be willing to shoot Russian planes out of the sky, and also to destroy Russian air defenses, which may be based in Russia itself. So to enforce the no-fly zone, they would have to do that. Now, NATO forces are technically capable of doing this, but doing so increases the risk of escalation, the risk that in response, Russia, rather than Mr. Putin, would then respond in kind. And, you know, war is inherently unpredictable. And once you enter a cycle of conflict like that, you really don't know where it's going to go. So NATO has an imperative, and this is the argument against the no-fly zone, to minimize the chances of further escalation, again, while helping Ukraine to do as much as it can. And we saw President Biden announce a huge package of military assistance to Ukraine yesterday. And that's the kind of aid that Ukraine needs. In the words of the UK Defense Secretary, the best kind of no-fly zone is perhaps one that Ukraine can provide itself through air defense and other weaponry.
We're talking to Sean Monahan, expert on European security and defense with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's with us today to talk about how NATO works and the position it's in during Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad NATO is still around, that the U.S. is still part of it? Do you think NATO countries, other ones, need to spend more on defense? What do you want to see NATO countries, including the U.S. and its allies, do when it comes to the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about NATO with Sean Monahan from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions about the NATO alliance, the U.S. role in it, and its role in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, its response there. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Saeed joins us now in Green Bay. Saeed, hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I am struck by the inconsistency in American foreign policy right now. If we are supporting the people of Ukraine, not because they're members of NATO, but because they are a people who are trying to defend their rights for democracy and self-determination, simultaneously with that, we are carrying out a negotiation with Iran. We're about to sign another agreement with the despotic regime in Iran that suppresses its own people, that has the blood of its own people on its hands. So we are going to empower them and negate the aspirations of Iranians for the very same things that the people of Ukraine want. Yet in one forum, we are sending arms and risking confrontation with a nuclear power. And on the other, we are recklessly disregarding the aspirations of Iranians for rights.
Saeed, thanks for that call. Sean, do you see those things at odds with each other?
the world of international politics is very complicated. I'm no expert on Iran and on the process to stop Iran getting developing nuclear weapons. There are several arguments as to the best way to do that. I think what I would say is the situation in front of us in Ukraine appears to be fairly simple. You have a large, powerful country with nuclear weapons, Russia, simply invading, subjugating, and bombing on a daily basis hundreds, if not thousands now, innocent civilians. And we have to decide whether that's the kind of behavior that we want to see in the world, and that we want the rules and the international order that we live in, if we want to accommodate that kind of behavior. So that's the kind of black and white problem in front of us in Ukraine. It's not an easy one. We were just discussing, the difficulties with deciding what military action to take. But the world is clearly united against Mr. Putin. The level of economic sanctions is absolutely historical and is having clearly a huge effect on the Russian economy. So we hope that has an effect on Mr. Putin's decision making.
Thanks for the call, Saeed. We'll go to Nate now in Sauk City. Nate, hello.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the call. I didn't hear all of the details of my predecessor's call, so I may be a little redundant. But I do want to say I believe the NATO and the U.S. need to be more robust, particularly in the I believe that the line between where we are currently and World War III is a little more gray than maybe the administration publicly portrays it. I don't know what they're doing but behind the scene, but I definitely feel very strongly that we cannot allow the Russians to gain a military advantage here in the Ukraine.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. As Sean, Nate sees a wider gray area between where we are now with support of Ukraine and the risk of touching off World War III, but it's a line you don't necessarily want to cross, right?
Exactly, Rob, exactly. It's the sheer unpredictability, and the leaders of the US and NATO just don't want to cross that Rubicon and kind of lose control of the situation. They have a strategy at the minute which could hopefully produce the goods, and that's Mr. Putin changing his mind and backing down, however unlikely that seems at the minute. The strategy of supporting Ukraine has put up an absolute fearsome resistance. It stopped the might of the Russian army in its tracks, and if we continue to help them do that whilst piling on the pressure economically, whilst isolating Russia diplomatically, then the strategy is that this will force Mr. Putin into changing his behavior.
Nate, thanks for the call. Joy joins us now in West Bend. Joy, hello.
Hi, thanks. I want to say that I would like all countries to respond by refusing to add to the arms, to add to the violence, to participate at all in violence. NATO is inherently really an offensive organization. If they're set up to say who's our allies and who are our enemies. We have United States has military installations in every corner of the world. So I'm not saying that Putin is doing something great. I think that nobody should have war anymore. As long as we have nuclear weapons, and even conventional weapons are so destructive, it's time to say, let's really use the UN. Let's not try to make allies and enemies.
Thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left, but Sean, I've seen calls to focus on the UN to do some of the things that NATO does. In the case of Russia has basically a veto vote on the Security Council.
Yeah, that's right. Russia's one of the permanent five members that can veto UN initiatives. But nonetheless, the UN has been doing a lot. Mm-hmm. And there was a historic vote in the General Assembly last week where an overwhelming number of countries voted to condemn what Russia and Mr. Putin are doing. And, you know, that shows that the weight of world opinion is totally against what's going on here. And that's really important still.
Thanks for that call, Joy. In our last minute or so, Sean, what are you watching for next from NATO in its response to this, now where we're kicking off the fourth week of this invasion?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yesterday NATO had a summit of defense ministers. And so next week's summit, President Biden is going over to Brussels. It'll be a leaders summit, an extraordinary leaders summit. I think the NATO summit yesterday with defense ministers, we can see some more of the same. So NATO essentially officially said, need to go back to the drawing board here. We need to reset our approach to defense and deterrence in Europe. And if you look at what some of the NATO members are doing, look at Germany, for instance, it's completely rewritten its foreign policy almost overnight. It's now providing lethal aid to Ukraine. It's looking at spending another 100 billion euros on defense. And that pattern is continued. Even Finland and Sweden now are thinking about joining NATO. So this is really a huge, you know, the tectonic plates of kind of European security are shifting. And NATO is at the foundation of that. So I think NATO just needs to look again at what it can do to provide to continue to be the most successful military alliance, you know, the world has ever seen, really, and provide security and stability in Europe. But it's clearly got a lot of work to do in the coming weeks and months. Rob,
Sean, thanks again for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's Sean Monahan. He's an expert on European security and defense with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was with us today for a conversation about NATO and what Russia's war in Ukraine means for the future of the military alliance.